Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
Hi guys, I'm Melissa. I just want to say really quickly before I get started, thank you to the committee for making our participation as Al-Anon possible, and for the folks that invited me to speak and that gave me my beautiful bouquet. I'm really, really, really grateful to be here. I look out in this room and I see the faces of so many people that I love, even the ones that I've never met. I love you too. I'm standing here today on the shoulders of so many men and women that helped me get to this point. Some of them sitting here with me. Some of them sitting out there in the audience. Some of them are in other states. I didn't get to be here by myself. Try not to jump around too much. I'm going to try not to cry, and I'm going to try not to cuss. I don't guarantee any of those. So I was taught when I very first started going to Al-Anon that I should identify who my qualifiers were. And I used to identify them as my father and my children's father and the people that are in my family. But what I came to learn as I worked through Al-Anon over the years is that my qualifier is myself, because it's my brain and my behavior that got me to the places that I was in before I started to get better. Maybe I had reactions to other people's behaviors, but the choices were mine. And that was a concept I didn't always understand. So I'll start off with saying that I was born into a ginormous Irish Catholic family. I heard somebody refer to it as the CIA, which is the Catholic Irish Alcoholics. And that definitely was true in my family. And I just need to say, I don't know if everybody's familiar with Al-Anon, but I know over the years that I've gone to meetings and gone to other functions like this, sometimes there's disconnect between AA and Al-Anon, because I know some of my AA family members, and certainly the one that I used to be married to, had a bad attitude about what happened in Al-Anon meetings. You know, thought maybe that we were just talking about them and being mean and conspiring for ways to make their lives miserable. And that's not what it's all about. I absolutely adore alcoholics. I prefer them to be in recovery, but I love alcoholics. Y'all are fun people. Like, you come up with great ideas, you throw excellent parties, you're in all the best bands. Like, you are good, fun people. I just need you to be in recovery. Just like Al-Anons, we're great people too. We have a purse that's full of all the things you could possibly need, even if you don't know you need it. We can tell you how to fix everything, including your life. We're better in recovery too. But within my Irish Catholic ginormous family, you know, my grandparents were alcoholics. My fantastic, wonderful, awesome father is an alcoholic. I have aunts and uncles that are alcoholics. Some of them identify that way and some of them don't. I have a lot of family members that would probably maybe benefit from coming to an Al-Anon meeting. I don't really know what that looks like for them, but I grew up in a great, close family. Like, all of that drinking notwithstanding, like, they were functional. Everybody held down jobs, everybody showed up for their kids, they showed up for me, we had a lot of parties. I'm very fortunate, and I loved being around those people. They were so much freaking fun. Like, my family members would get drunk, and instead of being mean, they would just tell stories, the same one, over and over again. And like towards the end of the story, maybe you couldn't really hear what they were saying because they were mumbling a little. They might fall asleep in the middle, you know, but it was a good time and everybody was still reliable and loving and funny and kind. And I know that's not everybody's experience, but that was mine. So as a result, I didn't really identify alcoholism as a problem because number one, that's not what we called it. You know, so-and-so liked their Budweiser a little too much, or this one, you know, she had too many hot toddies when she wasn't feeling well. Like, there was all these ways that we talked about it without really talking about it. And in my mind, growing up, an alcoholic was someone who didn't have shoes and didn't have a house, and, like, nobody liked them. And that wasn't what my experience was. Everybody liked my family. everybody liked my dad and my uncles, and like everybody was fun and cool, and like, why wouldn't you like them? They're awesome. But they were also alcoholics, you know, so there were some things that I learned growing up that I didn't know until like I was in my 40s that that probably wasn't normal. For example, I learned how to walk on eggshells before I learned how to roller skate. Because growing up in a household where one parent is an untreated alcoholic and the other parent is an untreated Al-Anon, there's a lot of things that you don't get to do in that house. We didn't talk about what was happening, because if we didn't talk about it, it wasn't happening. And that was, you know, my mom's primary way of handling things. That and making everything beautiful. Because my house was gorgeous. Like, everything was perfect. My parents didn't have a lot of money, but everything was always clean and neat, nicely decorated. We did all the holidays. Everything was like June Cleaver on acid, is what I used to say. And just, you know, if everything looked fine, then everything was fine. And I carried that attitude with me into my adult life. I learned when I was really young which friends were safe to have spend the night on the weekend in case my dad was this version of himself versus that version. Because I never knew. I learned quickly that the difference in his behavior depended on what type of liquid he was drinking. If it had bubbles or if it was flat. If it had bubbles, he was going to be fun. And there was going to be a lot of music and a lot of stories, and we'd probably dance in the yard at 9 o'clock at night when everybody else was sleeping. And if it was flat and required ice cubes, it was probably not going to be fun. But you never knew what you were going to get until it was already going, and not all of my friends could handle that. So not everybody was welcome to spend the night at my house. And the ones that were, I held on to very tightly because I didn't have to say things to them. And I didn't realize until I was older, they probably had something similar going on in their house too. And that's why they knew how to be at my house. I learned how to keep secrets really well because we didn't talk about what happened inside the house, outside the house. Carried that one into my adult life too. So some of these tools were useful for a long time, some of them not so much. I also learned how to be a chameleon growing up in an active alcoholic household because there was school me and there was home me and they were a lot different. And then there was like the me that I was with this group of friends and the me that I was with that group of friends, and I just kind of chameleoned myself into all these different versions of a person depending on who I was with because I just really wanted everybody to like me. I was like turbo speed people pleaser. And I learned that really, really young because I learned that if I brought good grades home and I kept my bedroom clean and everything was in order with my appearance, then everybody would be happy with me and nobody would yell at me, and that was really cool. So I tried to be perfect all the time. And that's a really, really hard thing to do. I remember being a little kid and going out in the garage, and my dad was looking for something. I think he was going to hang a picture for my mom or something. And so he was looking for a level. And I thought that level was so cool because he used it for so many things. And it was big, silver, shiny, and it had that little yellow bubble in the middle. And I would watch him try and balance it and like get everything lined up so that that bubble would stay in the center. And that had a really, really profound impact on me because I spent the rest of my life until I got into recovery trying to balance that level and keep that bubble in the middle. I balanced it with perfectionism and people-pleasing on this end, and then when that made me feel uncomfortable, then I got a little rebellious and I kind of went haywire over here, and then it would kind of get off whack. And I was always chasing that little bubble trying to keep everything even because I felt like if I could keep all of the stuff balanced, keep the bubble in the middle, then my dad would be happy and my mom would be happy and then I would be happy and everything would be fine. But that never works. That just never ever works. And it was hard to reconcile being so angry at my parents for being untreated in a disease they didn't even recognize that they had, while also loving them so much. That was a weird way to grow up, but I bet nobody in this room knows anything about that. All I remember is just wanting it to be the way that it wasn't, you know, like I wanted my dad to not drink. I wanted my mom to not yell. I wanted my brother to clean up his toys, you know, like I wanted everything to be perfect all the time. And it just didn't work out like that. It was good. It was a good, great childhood. We went on vacations. We had all the traditions. We had traditions to death because like, holy cow. You can't veer away from any of that kind of stuff because if you upset the balance, if you change the tradition, then the whole house of cards is going to fall apart. Like, oh my gosh. I don't know what was worse, having an untreated AA parent or an untreated Al-Anon parent, because man, it's both bad. It's two different kinds of crazy, but it's equally uncomfortable. And here you are as a kid, like standing in the middle going, I don't know what to do. And nobody's telling you except for be quiet and don't touch that. So as I was growing up and, you know, my parents were super strict with me, so there wasn't a lot of boyfriends and things like that. That didn't really happen much. But when I did fall in love with a guy, I thought that I was in the clear because he didn't drink alcohol. So I thought, okay, cool. So there's this whole section of stuff that I'm not going to have to deal with. Yay. Nope. He was super exciting. He was really charismatic. He was very funny. There was a lot of buzz around him all the time. And I fell madly in love with him. And everything in my life changed from that moment until, you know, 10 minutes ago, probably. No, that's not true. But I'll get to all that. I didn't think... Before I met him, I didn't think I was going to have any kids, and then I proceeded to have three. My last one is referred to, as some of the people in the audience might remember, as the Alla baby, because I had found Al-Anon by that point in time, and my Al-Anon friends threw me a baby shower for him, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So I got married. I had the great, big, huge, fancy, foo-foo, 325 people, you know, wedding. This might have been an indicator of the way things were going to go. I should have maybe paid a little bit more attention to that. My family is huge, like I said. And then there was all the people that you have to invite, right? Like your coworkers and their coworkers and your parents' coworkers and your babysitter and the neighbor and, you know, the guy that knew you when you were five and, like, you know, your dad's best friend from the Air Force and all that stuff. So there's all these people that are at the wedding, and we're doing the wedding things and taking the pictures and making the perfect day. And my grandfather, because I was the first grandchild, so my grandfather decided that the time that the venue had given us was not enough to party. So we all went back to his house, which wasn't very far away, to have the after party. Because doesn't everybody do that? Doesn't everybody have an after party after the party? Not really. So, but we did. And a couple of my uncles were enjoying their beverages. And then a fight broke out, which was kind of normal for a big Irish Catholic family, because this one's mad at that one, and then, you know, a fight broke out, and the cops came, and my wedding day was referred to forever after in the family as the May 4th Massacre. I don't wanted to pay more attention to that. I don't know. I missed some of that because I was already on my way to my honeymoon, but I heard stories later. Kind of think that would have been more fun. But yeah, that's what my wedding's referred to as, is the May 4th Massacre. Because those uncles were going at each other. They were, you know, their wives were getting involved, and the cops showed up, and somebody knocked the picture of the Pope off the wall, and then the Statue of Mary fell over, and it was all bad. All bad. It was something. There's pictures of that somewhere, I'm sure. You know, so after I got married, then I decided that it was... I wouldn't live with my children's father until I was married, because, like I said, I followed the rules and I was going to do everything right. I don't know why I thought that was going to make a difference, but I really believed that back then. It did not make a difference. But I moved into my married lady house, and I was doing all of the things. You know, I decided that it would be really important to make my own Christmas cards for the first Christmas. Yeah, I handmade Christmas cards and sent them to everybody that I had sent wedding invitations to, because surely I was going to stay in touch with all of those people forever. No. The first Christmas tree that I got as a married person, there used to be a place in Santa Clarita where you could go and cut your own tree down, kind of over by Magic Mountain, and we had gone and done that because that was tradition. So we went and did that with my parents and my grandparents, and I kept thinking, like, our ceiling is not that high. Like, we don't have room for that big of a tree. Like, I love your ambition, but I don't think that's going to fit. And my children's father insisted that tree was going to fit. And I thought, all right, well, we'll see. Well, we got the tree home, and it did fit, but no stand. We wedged it in between the floor and the ceiling. Like, oops, sorry. Walked it in like this. I guess it fit, you know. Again, problems with perception, right? Like, he saw it one way, I saw it another way. But, you know, and, like, I was a newlywed. I didn't have enough ornaments to decorate a tree that size. It was crazy. But, you know, that's the tree that I had that first Christmas. Lots of Christmases afterwards were magic. I don't know what it was about holidays in my marriage, but, like, holidays were always a time to have a big fight. I don't know if, like, that was something that made my children's father uncomfortable about Christmas or holidays, where we always got into a big knockdown drag out at the holidays and made it super memorable. Maybe something to do with expectations, but I didn't know what that word meant yet. I hadn't learned that one. So we were married for, I don't know, a couple years. I was 8 months pregnant with my second child, and I remember my children's father was a really busy guy. He had like this super important, really cool career that I think he still has, and his job kept him like all over the place with weird hours, and so it was hard to pin him down to talk to him. So what I liked to do as the person that I was back then, because I don't know if anybody else knows anything about this either, but I've been like six different versions of myself, like from then to now. So the girl I was back then would stand on the toilet next to the shower and lean over the top so that I could talk to my spouse about important things. Because that was the only time that he was in one place long enough to listen to me. So that poor guy never got to take a shower all by himself. Like, annoying thing to do. But like, I needed his attention and he was busy. So like, I could, you know, he was going to be there for a minute so I could run down some important things. So that one particular day, my children's father decided to tell me that he felt like he had a drug problem and he needed to go to rehab. And I didn't understand what he said. Like, I literally had absolutely no experience with that. I'd had some friends in high school that kind of went down some different roads and got a little sideways, but it was never that big of a deal that I knew of. And I just didn't know how to process that. So I stepped down rather than falling off the toilet as a pregnant person, because that wouldn't have been good. And I just sat on the floor and cried. And I thought, okay, what do we do about that? What do I do about what you just said? That's my first problem. There was really nothing for me to do, but I didn't know that yet. So I thought, okay, well, how are we going to fix this? Because like, I have this purse and it has all the things in it. I've got nail files and glue and Band-Aids and fabric softener and safety pins and like an extra pair of socks. And I probably have something in the bottom of that bag that can fix your problem. Just give me a minute. I'll find it, you know? And when he told me that he was going to go to rehab, I thought, okay, well, that's cool. Like, then you'll get better and everything will be fine. Wah, wah, wah. Spoiler alert, that's not what happened. He did go into rehab, and I did everything that Alan read in the Understanding Ourselves. That's like a blueprint for my behavior as an untreated Al-Anon person. I did all of that stuff and then some. Like, I was so good at all of those things that we weren't supposed to do, and I didn't even know it yet. So it was my responsibility to make sure that he got better, because that's my spouse, right? So that's what we're supposed to do. If you love someone, you fix them. So that's what I thought I was going to do. He went off and did his thing, and I was at home holding down the fort with, you know, by that time, my daughter was born, I believe. She was a newborn. So I had a newborn and a toddler, and I'm doing all the mom things, and I'm not telling anybody where he is. I just said that he was away for work because I was a super good enabler, and I didn't want anybody to think anything bad of him until later. And then I would tell you what to think of him. But at that time, I didn't want anybody to think badly of him. I wanted everybody to think that he was as wonderful as I still thought. So I kept all these secrets, and I didn't tell anybody where he really was. And I would drive down to where he was at and visit him and bring the kids. And everybody was dressed perfect, and we matched, and we took cute pictures, and it was awesome. And a handful of months later, after carrying all of that stuff and doing all of those things, I started to get physically sick. But I didn't know it. Like, I've always been this tall, but back then I weighed 113 pounds. And that's not a good weight for someone my height to be, but that's what was happening to me because I was so stressed out and I didn't recognize it. Because it was go, go, go. It was handle this, handle that, take care of this, make sure that's good, manage, manage, manage. And I really wasn't managing anything well. I was still making those handmade Christmas cards, though. That was super important. Handmade birthday cards, you know, like, I volunteered for everything. Anybody asked me to do something, I would do it, because anything I could do to stay away from looking at what was really going on, because that was too painful. So after a few months of his time away, my joke is that I had an allergic reaction to the news of his affair, because he met someone while he was there that understood him way better than I did, and, you know, cool. And but I had a bad reaction to that, and I broke out in charges and handcuffs. Got arrested for a felony, which is which was a weird experience for me because up until that point, I had only ever had a speeding ticket. I had a security clearance for a long time. I was like the girl that did everything I was supposed to do. I didn't break rules. Well, when I did, I broke them big, like really big, like publicly, like out in the world. People in the Antelope Valley saw me. They saw my crazy out on display. Like, it was a hot mess. And I got arrested. And the funny thing was, like, that was one of the first times that I had one of those is it odd or is it God moments, but I didn't recognize it until later. One of the officers that arrested me that day was the same one that had arrested him a few months prior. And he remembered me. And he did everything wrong. He did everything wrong. He didn't read me my rights. He didn't do this. He didn't do that. He screwed up all kinds of stuff. So it made it easier for the attorney that I wound up hiring later on to deal with all of that and get me some help. I was told that I needed to go to an Al-Anon meeting. So I did. The first one that I went to was out in Acton at that little white church that's on like Soledad Canyon, I think. It was like five people there. They were all my grandmother's age. That was weird. But I was like, all right, well, you know, obviously they're smiling, so something must be up. Like, I'm going to stick around and see what that's about. So I went to a couple of meetings there. That wasn't really my get down. And then I came to what was my home group for a long time. It used to be on Avenue K. It was the Monday night meeting, which COVID killed, unfortunately. But it used to meet on Avenue K and 51st Street West. And that was my home group for a long time. And over the 20 plus years that I've gone to meetings, I've had three sponsors. And my first sponsor I chose because she had really cool tattoos. And she was wearing a t-shirt from the same punk band that I really liked. So I thought, oh, duh, perfect. We're going to have all kinds of things in common. She's going to make me better. Not a great way to choose a sponsor. If anybody's ever had to do that, don't do it that way. I did zero work with that sponsor. Had zero growth. But I chose my second sponsor because someone suggested to me that you listen to what somebody says in a meeting and you want what they have. And this lady was laughing and she seemed comfortable and she had people that came and talked to her. She had friends. It was really cool. So that was my first sponsor. And I also was told to get a commitment at that meeting. So I did the coffee. I didn't even drink coffee. But I made coffee for everybody that came to the meeting and it got me there. It made sure I showed up every week. Another reason why I chose that meeting was because it had childcare. And I had two little kids, and I didn't always have somebody that could watch them for me because my children's father didn't think that I needed to go to an Al-Anon meeting. So he wasn't always available because he was really busy. He was still doing a lot of things. And I was grateful that that meeting had childcare because that was another way that I knew I was going to be able to get there. And at that meeting, I found some of my best friends, some of the people that I'm still close to today. A lot of them are here in this room. And I didn't think that that would happen. I didn't know what to expect. I certainly didn't think that I was going to find friends like I did. I still didn't think there was anything wrong with me, by the way. I still thought that all of the problems belonged to my children's father. And if that guy could just get himself sober and keep his equipment in his pants, everything would be fine. I didn't identify that I had any issues yet. Because for most of those first, like, probably 365 meetings that I went to, all I did was cry. Because I heard everybody else telling what was happening to me. You know, like, these men and women had been through the same stuff that I had been through. Maybe not identically, but it was the same stuff. It was the same childhood. It was the same marriage. It was the same terror of what am I going to do now? What happens next? And I think the thing that was so cool was that I realized that I wasn't alone. Because I felt really alone. I felt really alone when I was trying to keep the secrets and trying to not let anybody know what was really going on in my life. Because if you knew what was really going on, if you knew that those handmade Christmas cards were being made in a hellhole, you might not want to hold on to it. It might not be the memento that I was intending it to be. If you knew that the person standing in front of you had all of these dark, ugly secrets, you probably wouldn't want to be friends with her. But everybody in those meetings had the same secrets and the same pain, and I was so grateful to have found my people. And I wouldn't have found any of that if it hadn't been for the absolute Jerry Springer Lifetime movie train wreck that my marriage was. And I say that with lots of affection and respect, because someday I'm going to write a book and it's going to be a bestseller. And I wouldn't have all of that material if it wasn't for that marriage. Like, for example, I say I had a really good childhood and everything was cool and groovy, and it was. It wasn't as exciting as my marriage, though, because in my marriage, there were times where I had to go on vacation because we had to hide from people that were mad at my children's father. Sometimes those people were super scary biker dudes, and we had to go hide in other places and not be home. Like, I never thought that me, the girl with the security clearance and the straight A's who graduated in gold, would ever answer her front door, and there'd be a vago on the other side with a gun who wanted to come and search my house. But that's something that happened. And I never thought that I would answer the door one morning in my nightgown with my baby on my hip, and it would be an FBI agent on the other end of the door with a search warrant, but that happened too. And you know me, being the Al-Anon person that I am, I'm like, well, do you want some coffee? You know, like, are you hungry? Like, can I just made breakfast. Like, I'm sure there's enough for like seven of you. All right. Cool. Oh, you have a search warrant? Oh, you know right where you're looking? Go. I'm just going to sit here and breastfeed my daughter. Like, it's fine. You know, but those are things that happened while I was married. One time I had to go and live in another state under another name for 6 months. I pulled my kids out of school. I took off and drove in the middle of the night and didn't tell anybody where I was going because I wasn't safe. And I needed my children's father to deal with the mess that he had created for himself. And I needed to be removed from that, because by that time, I had had some recovery. I had a sponsor and I was going to meetings and I'd started to work steps, and I knew that there wasn't anything I could do about what was going on with that. But my responsibility was to myself and my kids. So I made the decision to do that, and I left in the middle of the night, and we were gone for almost 6 months. And people in Al-Anon and in AA took care of things while I was gone. You know, they looked out for us. They looked out for our home. They looked out for my kids and I. They kept in touch with us. I've never had anybody treat me as well as AA and Al-Anon people in recovery. Lots and lots of good friends, and they were right there alongside y'all. Like, I had this huge tribe of people that were always around me, but I didn't have the glasses to see everybody, you know, all the time over the years. And that experience showed me a lot of that. I stayed married for another couple years after that. I had some health problems, and I was still not completely clear on the concept of acceptance versus approval. Like, I struggled with that. I don't know if anybody else has ever struggled with that, but for me, I had a hard time deciding that if I said I accepted that this was the situation with my children's father, that meant that I approved of it. And I totally didn't approve of it. Like, how could you? There's nothing about that situation that's worth approval. But I didn't know until I did another round of step work and another fourth step and went to a retreat and spent some time on the floor on my face, because that's what my sponsor told me to do. Like, forget getting on your knees, get on your face and pray to your higher power and ask him for the guidance to figure out what's going on in your head and what you need to do next. Because I just didn't know. I was too close to the situation. I was way too much in love with my children's father, and I really wanted everything to be the way I thought it was supposed to be. I was deeply invested in that vision of my life. I had these three beautiful kids. I had this gorgeous house. I drove a cute car. I got to be a stay-at-home mom and the room mom. And I had FBI agents show up at my door, because those two things go together in my world. you know, so I was struggling with acceptance versus approval. But once I finally started to unlock that, everything just started sort of tumbling, and it made a lot more sense. And I realized that I could say that I accepted that this is a podium. And I can't make it a couch no matter how much I try. I can decorate it and I can put stickers on it and I can wish that it was a couch and it's still a podium. And so then I had to decide, like, do I want a podium in my living room or do I want a freaking couch? Like, I wanted a couch. So I got rid of the podium and I got no couch. I didn't have a couch for a long time. Metaphors, y'all. But I made the decision to get divorced after my health scare, because as an Al-Anon person, I recognize that my disease will not kill me as quickly as an AA's person, an AA person's disease will kill them, but it will kill me. I wound up having what they initially thought was a stroke. Turned out it was a cardiac event, but I was very unwell for a long time. I had to have heart surgery, And my doctor pointed out to me that that was a direct result of the stress that I was living with as a result of my own choices and my relationships with the people that I loved. And I almost died. Like, not to sound dramatic, but like, I almost died. I could have left my kids without a mother, with a non-sober father. What the hell would that have looked like for them? Like, my kids didn't ask to be my kids, you know? Like, they were given to me as a gift, and I was supposed to take care of them. And so I was like, all right, well, some things need to change. I've got to start doing some things different. I got to get extra super serious about my step work. I've got to make some real big changes. I can't just do this back and forth thing like I was doing, because I had made all kinds of threats that I did not carry out with that poor man that I was married to. I would kick him out when I would get mad. I would wish him dead. I planned his funeral. Like, I did all of this. I planned his funeral. I wasn't going to invite his mom, just so you know. Like, I was going to have guards at the front, and like, I was going to have this guest list of people that, because I had control issues, don't you know? And I wanted that funeral to be perfect. It was going to be a good funeral. I mean, I might go to prison for killing him, but it was going to be a good funeral. I had all these crazy ideas about the way things needed to go. My poor kids. Oh my gosh. So I was still living in my Barbie dream house, you know, I call it my big married lady house. And that was another extension of the way that I was raised, because if it looked good, it was good. It was a beautiful house. It was huge. It had a pool. It was in a perfect neighborhood. We hosted lots of parties. It was super awesome. I loved that house. But that house was where all the bad shit happened. And as I got better, I didn't want to be in that building anymore. Like, I needed to be someplace else, someplace that was just mine. Because I realized as I was getting divorced that there hadn't really been anything in my life up until that point that was just mine. And so here I was holding this bag of stuff that's just mine, and none of it was good. Like, it was lonely nights and crying kids and a really serious pain in the ass co-parent. And just navigating all of that, you know, like, what do I do? I didn't know what to do. My sponsor suggested that I had already been a single parent for a long time. I just didn't know it because I called it something different. Okay, that unlocked some things for me. That helped me. The traditions, tradition number one particularly, was the one that I based my new family life off of. That was the one that I used as the blueprint for the way we were going to move things forward, my kids and I. My kids are all grown up now. I don't know if they have my disease or their father's disease. I'm not sure what that looks like for them. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I know that they've learned lessons from me because I raised them in a program household, because I surrounded myself with program friends, the people that I keep my time with closely. They saw me go to meetings. They saw me be members of convention committees. We had the meeting after the meeting is what we called it at my house, because I lived nearby my Monday night meetings location, so people would come over afterwards and we'd have tea and hang out and smoke too many cigarettes and cry and tell stories. And I call my house the little hobbit house because it's a weird little house in a funky little neighborhood, you know, but it's mine. And it's the house that my kids are comfortable being in, and it's the house that they like bringing their friends to. And nobody has to worry about what I'm going to behave like on a Friday night at a sleepover, because I'm the same on Monday as I am on Thursday as I am on Sunday morning. Cranky if I don't get my coffee, but I'm the same person, you know? Over those years of learning how to rebuild my life and rebuild my family, I was given so many examples by people in the program. I'd go to open speaker meetings for AA speakers and Al-Anon speakers, and I learned so many things from those people that shared. Like, I heard a guy say one time that gifts come wrapped in a problem box, and I have shared that with so many people because that's what my whole life has been. I've had all these great gifts that I wouldn't have gotten if I ever didn't go to that first Al-Anon meeting. If I hadn't been married to somebody that had the problem in their life that caused me to have the problem in my life that got me to my first meeting. I got to learn how to go back to work full-time because I hadn't worked full-time in a long time. I'd been a stay-at-home mom. My resume was out of date. My security clearance was long since expired, and I had nothing valuable to offer, I thought. But a friend in the program whose husband had a business here locally gave me a job and a shot, and I got to be a waitress until I was able to be something else. And then after that, I was something else. And then I was something else until I got to the point where I got to be a federal background investigator. And I got to carry a badge. And I actually got to go to the FBI office one time and show them my badge. instead of the other way around. And that was a really cool full circle moment for this girl. It wasn't the guy that was involved with my situation, but I was like, you see that? Like, you see that? That's me right there. And now I, like yesterday was my last day with that job, and I accepted a position with another agency also working for the government. And like, you know, I finished that day, and then I'm here today, and I'm sharing this, and I'm sharing the fact that you can be absolutely on your face, humiliated, unsure of where your life is going to go, but if you get your sorry butt to a 12-step meeting and you make some friends and you take some direction, you can get better and you can have a really good life. And I didn't know what my life was going to look like, but I wouldn't have had any of this if it wasn't for Al-Anon and the people that shared their experiences with me, the people that showed up at my Barbie dream house when I had to move out of it. 21 people showed up the day that I moved out and did like a fire brigade of boxes. And more than half of those people, oh, it's going to make me cry. More than half of those people were members of AA that knew my former husband or knew me because they knew him. And they just showed up to help. Some of them didn't even know me, but they showed up and there was this fire brigade of boxes, and these men and women just got all those boxes out and helped me move. And then a friend of mine was there with me when I locked that key in the door for the last time. And you guys know what? That key broke. That key broke, and I was like, okay, I get it. I'm moving on. I'm letting go. I understand. Like, I need things to be real concrete, right? I need, like, big examples. And so that night, another friend of mine took me down to Hollywood to see my favorite punk band, and I started my next chapter by leaving it all in the pit, which is what I love to do the most. might not look like it, but that's my thing. And I would love to say that I never looked back, but that would be a lie. I look back all the time. Not in an unhealthy way, I don't think, but I look back at where I was so that I remember what happened. And that's why I'm grateful for this opportunity today to share some of my story with you guys, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all of that. You know, I'm grateful for all of those bad days and all of those scary moments and all of that uncertainty. I'm not certain of things every day, but I'm certain of my gratitude. That thing I know I'm certain of always. I had a sponsor that taught me to do the alphabetical gratitude list, because everybody can come up with something. Start with A, go to Z. Sometimes I'll get apple. B, bathtub, because I like to take baths. Okay, I'm grateful for my bathtub. And I taught my kids to do that too. We still use that tool. If you're ever finding yourself spinning out over somebody else's behavior, may I respectfully suggest counting your light switch covers? You probably don't know how many you have, but maybe you should go and do a count if you ever feel yourself getting a little spun out, because it'll take you outside of your circumstances and get you calmed enough, just maybe so that you can hear your higher power, or you can make a phone call, or you can answer a phone call. Like, you know, I know in Al-Anon meetings, we say when we get busy, we get better, and like, taking phone calls, sponsoring people, attending meetings, reading my literature. Another thing, I find it's better if I read my literature in the beginning of the day instead of the end of the day. It's better to start it off that way than to look back in retrospect and go, oh, dang. Well, that might have helped. So, you know, my organization is a little bit better now. I learned in Al-Anon how to have relationships with people. Friendships, romantic relationships. My picker is better than it used to be. My learning curve is shortened. Like, most of my bad relationships after my marriage only lasted 6 months. Nobody got to 6 months in a day because I have boundaries now. And like, I knew how to be like, oh, no, you can take that back to your mom. I'm not doing it. Like, we're not doing that. No, sir. I'm not going to tell you what to do anymore, but I'm going to tell you I'm not doing it with you. Like, that's definitely a thing. And I wouldn't have learned that either, you know, like so much about, like, I tell people all the time, like, I absolutely owe my sanity and my peace and my life and my happiness to Al-Anon, and the fact that people were patient with me and didn't give up on me and let me find my way and work these steps and get better. I would not be a decent human being if it wasn't for Al-Anon. I don't think I was terrible before, but damn, I was crazy. I was hard to live with. Could you imagine? Like, think about trying to take a shower and somebody's like, up over the top of the shower, giving you no peace and no space. No. Like that smug, self-righteous thing, she's standing right here. I was super good at that. I made notes. I had an outline of all these things that I was going to say, and I didn't say most of them. Because the other thing that I learned is God works through me, and he tells me what I want to, he makes come out what needs to be heard. And I hope that you guys got something useful, or, you know, I know you laughed, so that's cool. And I'm just really grateful that the committee, again, asked me to be here. I hope I'm okay on time. It's a real privilege to be a member of an Al-Anon family group. It's a privilege to have worked these steps and to have met all of you people, and I will forever love alcoholics and Al-Anons. Like I said in the beginning, I would just prefer that everybody was in some recovery. I think the whole world could use a 12-step meeting, but that's me being in charge, and I'm not supposed to do that. So until everybody finds their way to one, I'll just keep coming back. Thank you, guys.